Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. This is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. Page 2, read. Neuroscience major reflects on impact of early college high school program by Rebecca Bell, MC Communications Department. Pictured, Jamie Gomez and her dog Jabba. Courtesy photo. Midland. Jamie Gomez has lived in Midland her entire life, and now she is ready for adventure in a new city. So on August 24th, she began classes at the University of Texas, UT, in Austin. The 18-year-old early college high school at Midland College, ECHS at MC, 2020 salutatorian, is taking junior-level college courses, majoring in neuroscience. I first became interested in psychology and how the brain functions when I took a Midland College psychology class with Professor David Edens, Gomez explained. We were studying autism, and I remember talking with Professor Edens after class about the relationship between autism and high intelligence. I wanted to know more about how physiology, anatomy, and molecular biology combine in the brain to determine our behavioral and cognitive functions. Gomez said that she applied to and was accepted at several major universities, including Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Daniel Dickinson is conducting research on single molecule studies of cell polarity at UT, and the opportunity to work with him interested me, Gomez said. An added bonus is that UT is close to home. Jamie Gomez attended various elementary schools in Midland and was in the Gifted and Talented program at Midland ISD's Carver Center. While she was in the eighth grade at San Jacinto Junior High, Gomez completed the rigorous ECHS at MC application and then began the accelerated high school college curriculum in fall 2016. Her older sister, Julie Gomez, is also an ECHS at MC graduate. Because my sister went to early college high school, I already knew it was going to be tough when I applied, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity to earn an associate degree by the time I graduated from high school, Gomez said. It was also a tremendous cost savings. Gomez has a 4.0 GPA in both her high school and college courses at ECHS at MC. She is a Midland College Honors Scholar and participated in various honors projects under the direction of MC professors. She said that her favorite project was studying the works and life of early Renaissance artist Lorenzo Ghiberti. Gomez was also a member of Phi Theta Kappa, the International Community College Honors Society. While her chosen major centers on science, Gomez said that she really enjoyed her Midland College English classes, especially writing and American literature courses with Stacy and Brendan Egan. As a creative outlet, she enjoys arts and crafts projects. She recently designed and created a cowboy hat for her dog Jabba and a painting on the back of a jacket for a friend. Gomez is the daughter of Deborah Sanchez, and even though she will be leaving her mother, dog Jabba, and close friends, Gomez said she is ready for a change. I like to surround myself with people who aren't always interested in the same things that I am, Gomez stated. For example, I purposefully didn't want a roommate who was also a science major. My roommate is majoring in journalism. We didn't know each other before we started living together. I think going to early college high school made me more interested in getting to know other people. In my Midland College courses, I was able to meet and work on projects with all kinds of people, not just my high school friends. I'm really looking forward to making new connections at UT. The improbable rise of Joe Biden. Donald Trump may have won the most unlikely presidential election victory in U.S. history, but no one has ever taken a longer, more treacherous road to the White House than Joe Biden. If he should win, he will confirm that in American politics, nothing is ever final. He arrived in the U.S. Senate barely old enough to meet the constitutional age requirement of 30. He had eked out a long-shot victory over an incumbent Republican in 1972, even as the GOP presidential nominee, Richard Nixon, carried 49 states. Biden's Senate career nearly ended before it began. His wife and year-old daughter died in an auto accident just weeks after his election. Consumed by grief and fearful of being away from his two young sons, who were injured in the crash, Biden decided to quit before taking office. His fellow Democratic senators finally persuaded him to give it 6 months. Initially, he had no enthusiasm for his new responsibilities. "I did what was necessary and no more," he wrote in his autobiography. "I later learned that staffers from other offices were laying bets. How long would Biden last in the job?" His youth and views rankled some older senators, including a crusty Southerner who said, "They tell me you're the youngest man in the history of America ever elected to the U.S. Senate. Y'all keep making speeches like you made today, and you're going to be the youngest one-term senator in the history of America." Biden remarried happily, and during his Senate years, he grew from the brash upstart to the respected veteran, chairing the Judiciary Committee and the Foreign Relations Committee. In 1987, he ran the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork and was instrumental in Bork's defeat. Biden, reported the New York Times at the time, earned praise from all sides for the fairness and good humor with which he ran the proceedings. He also scored high points on substance in the face of widespread skepticism about whether he had the intellectual depth or the temperament to preside over hearings that promised to turn into a profound constitutional debate. It was a performance that might have set up a presidential run, except that it came after Biden had entered the 1988 race and quit after being exposed for plagiarism in a law school paper and a campaign speech. It was a disaster that might have doomed his chances of re-election. If that weren't enough, he nearly died of two brain aneurysms in 1988. He survived physically and politically, but compiled a record that would later dog him. He presided over the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Clarence Thomas and was criticized for failing to adequately pursue accusations of sexual harassment against the nominee. Biden took a leading role in passing the 1994 crime bill, which is now blamed for fostering the mass incarceration of black men. In 2007, he made a second bid for the presidency, only to drop out after getting just 1% of the vote in Iowa, as Barack Obama won with 38%. Biden's dismal showing was enough to bury his hopes of ever being president. But Obama resurrected them by putting him on the ticket. As vice president for a popular outgoing president, Biden should have had an inside lane for the 2016 presidential nomination. But no, he polled far worse than Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and the death of his son, Beau, in May 2015, effectively prevented him from running. When he announced he would not enter the race, Evan Osnos wrote in The New Yorker, "Biden is giving up his last chance at the role that he has always wanted." That conclusion made sense given Biden's age. When he decided to enter the 2020 race, it was easy to picture Democrats being captivated by some younger candidate, a woman or a person of color, instead of an elderly, gaffe-prone white man who seemed like a relic of the 20th century. But when Democratic voters got their say, they preferred him, flaws and all. At the moment, so do Americans in general. In polls, Biden has held a consistent lead over Donald Trump for the past year. When he rebounded to come in second in the 1992 New Hampshire primary, Bill Clinton dubbed himself the Comeback Kid. If Biden wins on November 3rd, it will cap a comeback like none American politics has ever seen. Chapman, Stephen Chapman. Chapman writes for the Chicago Tribune as well as being a syndicated columnist. Find out more. Read Chapman's daily blog, www.chicagotribune.com/news/opinion/Chapman.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020. This is the business and oil page. This article is entitled Restaurants Face Labor Shortage Despite High Unemployment by Nick Carollo and Leslie Patton, Bloomberg News. Not even the greatest surge in joblessness in 80 years is easing the fast food industry's years-old labor shortage. That's because the COVID-19 pandemic is making this year's economic crisis very different than past downturns, when restaurants offered an important lifeline for the newly unemployed. Since service sector jobs now mean a higher chance of infection, even higher pay isn't coaxing workers into the kitchen. Key demographics, like teenagers at the urging of their parents and the elderly, are staying away for health and safety reasons, and emergency-enhanced unemployment checks have kept others on the sidelines. Restaurant chains are reporting they're paying more, but that doesn't mean they're filling their staff openings. This is the most dramatic shift that's happened in the modern history of food service, said Aaron Allen, chief strategist at restaurant consultancy Aaron Allen & Associates. It's the first time people have left the industry and decided not to come back. As of mid-July, only about half of the 6.1 million food service jobs that the U.S. lost in March and April had returned, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics data. Early in the pandemic, restaurant chains pared menus, reduced store hours, and cut staff. While many traditional restaurants continue to struggle as consumers avoid dining rooms, fast food chains, and those with carryout have reported steady improvements this summer as socially distancing consumers opt for drive-thrus. Delivery-focused companies like Papa John's International and Domino's Pizza, meanwhile, have thrived. To capitalize on the rebound, McDonald's Corporation said in June that it planned to hire 260,000 this summer. Subway, Taco Bell, Dunkin' Brands Group, Inc., Papa John's, and Chipotle Mexican Grill are also looking to expand payrolls on a smaller scale, but the lack of workers is complicating efforts. Michael Lippert, president of GPS Hospitality LLC, which operates almost 500 Burger King, Popeyes, and Pizza Hut locations, said hiring has been particularly tough because fewer teenagers are applying. This has pushed up wages and led the company to expand overtime, previously reserved for management, to hourly workers. In August, the company held a virtual job fair with a target of hiring 3,000 workers. The economic environment likely is not going to change. If it does, I don't know that it will improve, he said. I think the labor force will remain tight for the next several months. Flynn Restaurant Group, which operates Taco Bell, Arby's, and Applebee's locations, said it's now paying hourly workers more than it did a year ago at 280 Taco Bell restaurants. While keeping restaurants fully staffed has always been difficult, the uncertainty around COVID has made this even more of a challenge, said Greg Flynn, the company's founder and chief executive officer. He added the task remains daunting in spite of high jobless rates and economic contraction. Wendy's company is forecasting a 4% wage inflation for the year. The higher wages are what you need to pay at the moment on a year-over-year basis to actually staff your restaurants, said Gunther Plosch, the company's chief financial officer, on Wendy's second quarter earnings call on August 5th. But higher pay isn't enough for workers like Alonzo Rice in Orlando, Florida. A former Burger King cook and member of the Fight for the $15 campaign to increase restaurant wages, Rice has been working odd jobs since his restaurant hours dwindled and then disappeared altogether amid the pandemic. He's now starting to apply for jobs again, but his old line of work just isn't worth the risk, he said. I'm not applying to any restaurant jobs. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled Democrats Can't Allow Far Left to Hijack the Party by Jonah Goldberg, Tribune News Service. Last week, a mob of white protesters swarmed a white woman eating dinner in the Adams Morgan neighborhood of Washington, D.C. Video of the bullies demanding that patrons raise their fists in solidarity with the movement went viral. Many pro-Trump and right-wing media personalities were quick to insist this verbal assault was emblematic of the entire Democratic Party and the broader American left. Never mind that the victim, Lauren B. Victor, was a fellow progressive who told a Washington Post reporter, "I'm very much with them. I've been marching with them for weeks and weeks and weeks." Among the funny things about this decidedly unfunny event is that it would have been almost impossible for this roving rhetorical goon squad to find the kind of victims they surely wanted. Adams Morgan is an especially liberal neighborhood in a very liberal city. Sure, there are some conservatives there. I lived in Adams Morgan for over a decade, but picking on random white people in Adams Morgan in the hope of finding MAGA types is like scouring Manhattan's Upper West Side for taxidermists. It's theoretically possible to find one, but you'll have your work cut out for you. Regardless, Democrats would be well advised to draw inspiration from Victor's refusal to be bullied by the mob, even one she sympathizes with, because she is surely more representative of voters than the mob accosting her was. American liberalism's Achilles heel has long been a reluctance, sometimes a flat-out inability, to criticize radicals to their left. In the 1960s, leading Democrats kowtowed to extremists of what historian Fred Siegel called a riot ideology, and it cost the party dearly. There have been exceptions. Americans for Democratic Action arguably saved the Democratic Party from its leftmost wing, led by the useful idiot Henry Wallace, FDR's former vice president. Bill Clinton broke the GOP's monopoly on the presidency by deliberately picking fights with the left in order to attract more moderate voters. Clinton's tactics were arguably more cynical than idealistic. He took time off from the campaign trail to oversee the execution of a severely brain-damaged black man. But say what you will about his triangulation, it worked. American politics has become a contest between two competing caricatures of reality. The primary driver of this dynamic has been the media's, particularly cable news, addiction to narrative journalism combined with the pernicious influence of social media. Twitter and Facebook make it all too easy to shine a spotlight on outlier events and present them as central to our lives. The focus on the ludicrous autonomous zone in Seattle earlier this summer left the right claim the whole city was like a Mad Max movie. Similarly, the statistically rare, I'm sorry but it's true, examples of outrageously bad behavior by some cops captured on video give many on the left permission to push a narrative of wholesale racial oppression by the police. Social media is like the wall on Plato's cave. Selective facts cast shadows we mistake for reality. If you take all your cues about what's happening in America from partisan Twitter, as so many journalists do, you'd be a fool not to buy a gun and prepare for the coming apocalyptic helter-skelter. The problem is intensified by the tendency of the hyper-politically engaged left and right to listen only to people in their own echo chamber and to mistake Twitter outrage for sentiment on the ground. So despite the fact that a majority of black and Latino people want the same amount or more police in their communities, we spent weeks listening to experts claim that abolish the police is a reasonable mainstream position. Here's an illustrative heuristic. If you hear politicians or journalists use the label Latinx to describe Latinos, you're listening to someone in a bubble. According to a recent Pew Research Center polling, only about 25% of Latinos know the term, and only about 3% actually use it. Joe Biden won the Democratic nomination largely because most of his competitors talked as if primary voters were indistinguishable from the very online left-wing activists and journalists who dominate MSNBC and CNN. To his credit, Biden has unequivocally condemned rioting, vigilantism, and street violence. But he took too much time to do it. Not because he doesn't believe what he said, but because the campaign let the fringe define the center of the party. Condemning violence by rioters and vigilantes alike is a no-brainer. It's pre-partisan, patriotic requirement of political leadership. Hesitation to do so is not merely shameful. It's political malpractice because most voters expect it, and even the appearance of reluctance feeds precisely the narrative that could cost Biden the election. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, Biden Won't Blame Dems for Rioting, by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Until a few days ago, Democrats were content to pretend the disorder in American cities didn't exist. Now, worried that Joe Biden is on his back foot on the issue, they readily acknowledge the rioting and blame it on President Donald Trump. One would think that given the fusillade they unleashed against Trump at the convention, if Democrats truly believe that the president is responsible for Black Lives Matter activists and anarchists attacking cops and burning down buildings, they would have mentioned it at least once. But no, they didn't bring it up, in keeping with how progressives have minimized the violence all along as inconvenient to a narrative of courageous young people rising up against systemic racism. There's no doubt that Trump constantly stirs the pot and often acts more the Twitter provocateur than the president. But this is an abdication of the important part of his leadership role. But it's not him or his allies torching businesses and vandalizing public property. The violence has overwhelmingly racked cities governed by Democratic mayors and city councils for decades. They run the police departments, the schools, and the housing authorities. If cops are violent and corrupt, it's on them. If they are such miserable places to live that they are powder kegs, it's on them. If they can't maintain basic order, it's on them. If Joe Biden thinks these localities are doing a poor job, he can say so. But of course, since blue mayors are his allies, he won't say a discouraging word. Portland continues to be a flashpoint. The city and state authorities have had more than 100 days to get the city under control, which shouldn't be mission impossible. We're talking about a mid-sized city in the Pacific Northwest of the United States of America, not Juarez, Caracas, or San Salvador. Even after years of coddling left-wing extremists, Portland could control its streets if it had the will. It doesn't. Mayor Ted Wheeler wants to cater to the mob as much as possible, even if the mob doesn't like him very much. He apologized earlier this summer for the Portland police allegedly using excessive tear gas and issued guidance saying cops could only use it if they feared injury or death. Wheeler showed up at the federal courthouse when it was being besieged by unruly crowds to demonstrate his sympathy, and for his trouble got shouted at and jostled. A security team protected him. Even as Wheeler traded barbs with Trump over the weekend, protesters staged a sit-in in the lobby of his condo building, demanding that he cut police budget by half and then eliminate the police entirely. They also call on him, as an embodiment of white supremacy, to resign. Wheeler's fecklessness is matched by that of the local prosecutor. The Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt has been dropping most of the charges against rioters. As the Oregonian reported, His prosecutors won't pursue demonstrators accused of interfering with police, disorderly conduct, criminal trespass, escape, or harassment unless they've deliberately targeted property or people. None of this is Trump's fault and runs counter to his inclinations. It wasn't anything Trump said or did that set off the initial nationwide unrest a few months ago. It was a spontaneous reaction to the death of George Floyd, which Trump repeatedly condemned. The dynamic has been the same, only on a larger scale, as Ferguson, Missouri, while Barack Obama was president. Anger at police action, followed by rioting, treated with kid gloves by the media. Everyone knows there are different rules for Black Lives Matter. If a conservative movement with the cachet and corporate support of BLM staged an event featuring a single act of arson, the group would be shunned and its cause discredited. That this would never happen to Black Lives Matter acts as a giant permission slip, and it's not Trump writing it, but all the people now blaming him for the rioting. This column is entitled, "No, America Will Not Be Canceled," by Tyler Cowen, Bloomberg. One of the most hotly debated questions among my friends and acquaintances lately is this. Is America headed for a future in which just about everyone has been canceled? Fortunately, while cancel culture and political correctness have become stronger and more influential over the past few years, those movements have built-in limitations. They will prove to be a durable element of American culture, but by no means a dominant one. How do I know? I don't, of course, but consider which recent developments have most captivated young people and grabbed their attention. The first is the gaming ecosystem Fortnite, with about 350 million global users. The second is the short video platform TikTok, which now has 80 million active users in the US alone. Both are huge worlds unto themselves and both resist easy generalization. But it is safe to say they are not bastions of political correctness. The primary purpose of both is to entertain their users. While Fortnite offers non-egalitarian competitive gaming based on violent combat, TikTok rewards brashness and irreverence. One of the main characteristics of PC culture is humorlessness. In a world where attention is dominated by entertainment, along with social bonding and networking, political correctness will not be the major cultural influence. So what to make of the apparent growing strength of cancel culture and affiliated movements? Here's the fundamental point. With the rise of social media and low-cost communications, virtually everything that can be said will be said. It might be said on Twitter rather than on the evening news, or on 4chan rather than Facebook, but the sentiments will be out there, and many of them will be disturbing. The world has arrived at a place where just about every politically incorrect statement and a response to it, not to mention every politically correct statement and a response to that, is published or recorded somewhere. So the policing of speech may be vastly more common than it was, say, 15 years ago. But the discourse itself is vastly greater in scope. Political correctness has in fact run amok, but then so has everything else. As a general principle, people notice what disturbs them more than what doesn't. Therefore, opponents of political correctness, and I include myself in this group, have a never-ending supply of anecdotes to be concerned about. I'm not suggesting that this cycle will end well, but it does put the matter in perspective. The issue of how social norms will adjust to cope with a world where everything is being said all the time. That path will not be smooth, but anxiety about it from fear of political correctness simply swallowing up everything and canceling everybody. I'm no optimist. In fact, I suspect it will be harder to rein in the chaos and bewilderment from the say-whatever-you-want culture. Have you checked out the pandemic discourse lately? Than to curb the intemperance of the you-can't-say-that culture. Consider also the evolution of internet communication. For all its diversity, there are significant trends towards centralization. The English language is more focal than before. National politics command more attention than local politics, and the U.S. itself has more soft power in some crucial directions, thanks to its central role in the Internet's intellectual infrastructure. It is striking, for example, how much the entire world responded to the Black Lives Matter movement. That means Americans will be subject to more cancellations and to more political correctness than people in the rest of the world. For better or worse, Americans are the central nexus that so many others are talking about, not always favorably. To quote Joseph Heller, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't after you. And Americans have good reason to be paranoid these days. If you published your politically incorrect column in your local Croatian newspaper, the rest of the Internet just wouldn't care all that much. Yet note the underlying assumption here, namely that American soft power is indeed growing. And if you are an American intellectual, your relative influence around the world is likely to be growing as well. With that greater influence comes greater scrutiny, and greater risk that you will be treated unfairly by the PC brigades. Is that really such a bad trade-off? I, too, am concerned about the growth of the PC movement, including in my own sector of academia. That doesn't mean, however, that the movement's critics are identifying its problems with sufficient acuity, or that Americans' future is destined to be filled with cancellations. This is the oil page. This article is entitled Schlumberger to Sell U.S. Canadian Fracturing Business by David Weth, Bloomberg. Schlumberger has become the biggest oil service industry player yet to abandon fracturing work in North America, a sign that activity in the U.S. shale patch may never revisit previous highs. The provider of drilling and oil production equipment agreed to sell its U.S. and Canadian fracturing business to smaller rival Liberty Oilfield Services, Inc. After similar exits over the past few years by Baker Hughes Company and Weatherford International PLC, Halliburton Company is now the sole global provider of well completions for shale, and even Halliburton has said it's looking at overseas for better growth. For Schlumberger, the world's top oil field services company, the deal is a massive reversal from its North American buying binge over the past few years, which added frac sand mines, artificial lift technology, and Weatherford's frac fleet. For Liberty, meanwhile, buying Schlumberger's one stim unit in exchange for a 37% stake in the company means the oil field contractor will more than double the size of its frac fleet in a market that has sidelined three-fourths of U.S. crews this year. The COVID pandemic has thrown the world for a loop, bringing serious threats to our industry, Chris Wright, chief executive of Denver-based Liberty, told analysts and investors Tuesday on a conference call. But these dark hours are most fertile for opportunity. The historic crash in oil prices, along with a glut of fracturing gear, has triggered a crisis that has driven some frackers into bankruptcy. The combination with OneStim, which is expected to close in the final 3 months of the year, will make Liberty the second biggest U.S. fracker with 2.3 million horsepower, according to Citigroup, Inc. The last several months have been extremely challenging for the world, the industry, and the Liberty family, Wright said in a statement announcing the deal. This transaction will be a transformative step forward in our journey as a company. Schlumberger's sale comes less than 3 years after it acquired Weatherford's fracturing unit for $430 million. Liberty said Tuesday it plans to scrap 1 million horsepower, essentially the former Weatherford fleet, amid an industry-wide glut. As shale explorers heeded investor calls to rein in spending, fracking demand has dwindled. Beginning late last year, frac providers took the unusual step of scrapping much of their idle equipment. The business started to show signs of recovery at the start of 2020 until the pandemic paralyzed economic activity and the energy usage that underpins it. By July, Schlumberger was describing the decline in fracking demand as, quote, precipitous, unquote, contributing to a 40% plunge in second quarter revenue. The Liberty Deal is the latest move by Schlumberger CEO Olivier Le Peuch to adjust to the oil crash. The company has announced plans to cut more than 21,000 workers and reshuffle its business around the globe. The transaction is consistent with CEO Olivier Le Peuch's comments about not needing to own frac assets. His strategy for SLB to become asset light and licensing SLB technology to other companies, Kurt Hallead, an analyst at RBC Capital Markets, wrote in a note to investors. Liberty surged as much as 42% for its biggest intraday gain ever, while Schlumberger dropped as much as 2.9% on Tuesday. This article is entitled "Permian Highway Pipeline Clears Legal Hurdle" by Adrian Hedden, Carlsbad Current Argus. A federal judge in West Texas ruled in favor of a natural gas pipeline that would connect Permian Basin extraction operations with Gulf Coast refinery markets, as the Sierra Club sought to block the pipeline due to its perceived threat to the environment along the route. Kinder Morgan's $2 billion Permian Highway Pipeline would stretch about 430 miles from Waha in the Permian to the Gulf Coast via a 42-inch line. It would cross through central Texas and terminate southeast of Austin, with the ability to access the liquefied natural gas market on the Gulf Coast, along with gas markets in Agua Dulce and Katy. The project faced stiff opposition as it passed through Texas Hill Country, where residents and environmental groups maligned an incident earlier this spring when drilling fluid was spilled into the Blanco River as a pipeline was being built beneath. Kinder Morgan subsequently announced it would seek plans to reroute the line along the river. It was also challenged as it crossed through hundreds of water crossings, allegedly imperiling sensitive ecosystems, karstic formation, and endangered species. The Sierra Club filed a motion in April for an injunction to halt pipeline construction, citing the current and future damage the project would cause to the environment during its ongoing construction and future use. The motion also alleged the pipeline did not receive proper permitting despite permits issued by the Army Corps of Engineers, which the Sierra Club argued did not involve proper environmental analysis. But U.S. District Judge Robert Pittman for the Western District of Texas argued in his denial of the motion that the Sierra Club had not demonstrated adequate future impacts as the pipeline was almost completed with an expected in-service date in early 2021. Pittman also contended that most of the impacts outlined in the Sierra Club's motion had already taken place, and an injunction against future construction would not provide any relief. Unfortunately, granting an injunction at this stage of the pipeline's completion would not unring the bell, Pittman wrote in his opinion. Harm that is extremely unlikely to occur is not a definitive threat of future harm warranting a preliminary injunction. In response to the court's decision, Sierra Club staff attorney Joshua Smith argued the pipeline had provenly damaged the environment during the project, as admitted in Pittman's decision. Construction of the Permian Highway Pipeline has already done significant damage to waterways and communities along its route, and it will do even greater damage if completed, Smith said. Indeed, the court itself recognized that the pipeline has caused a great deal of harm to the environment. More. Sale of New Mexico public land to oil and gas nets $8 million despite opposition during COVID-19. He said the organization intended to pursue other legal options to stop the Permian Highway Pipeline from being built and operated. We are disappointed that the court declined to put an immediate stop to this illegal construction, and we are evaluating our options going forward, Smith said. We believe we are right on the law, and we are confident we would ultimately be successful in our challenge to this dangerous fracked gas pipeline. The Grow America's Infrastructure Now, GAIN Coalition, an organization made up of trade associations, businesses, and labor groups around the U.S., defended Pittman's decision and the project as essential to encourage economic development brought on by oil and gas. More. Trump administration curbs federal oil and gas emissions standards. Here's where New Mexico stands. Today's decision is an important step in recognizing the tremendous lengths the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Kinder Morgan took to ensure the Permian Highway Pipeline would not have any measurable impact on the wildlife native to the area, said GAIN Coalition spokesman Craig Stevens. The U.S. energy industry and its regulators take careful consideration of the natural habitat where they work and spend tremendous time and treasure minimizing impact to those areas. Stephen said the project received adequate oversight from state and federal regulators, and when complete, the project would provide an essential delivery method for Permian Basin natural gas to U.S. and global energy markets. We are heartened the court agreed that when companies follow the law and guidance from regulators, they can be provided with certainty that their projects can proceed, he said. We look forward to final completion and ultimate operation of the PHP, which will deliver natural gas from the Permian region of Texas to markets across the U.S. and around the world. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This article is entitled "Oil Up on Expectations of Shrinking United States Stockpiles" by James Osborne, Houston Chronicle. Washington. The Trump administration is revising regulations governing oil and gas drilling across more than 190 million acres of U.S. forest land in a bid to increase the nation's energy production. Under draft rules that were published Tuesday, the U.S. Forest Service would be limited in its ability to conduct environmental reviews of drilling projects, while oil and gas companies would not be required to provide as much notice to the public. The administration has described the moves as designed to reduce unnecessary red tape and speed permitting decisions, not to put the environment at risk. Despite increasing concern around climate change, President Donald Trump has made loosening regulations around the production of oil and other fossil fuels a top priority for his administration. So far, the impact of those efforts has been limited by environmentalist legal challenges, tying up regulatory changes in court in hopes of a change in power following the November election. Conservative groups signaled Monday they would fight the proposed changes to forest land regulations, saying it would make it more difficult for the Forest Service to review and stop oil and gas projects harmful to the environment. Tens of millions of people use and enjoy the national forests each year for a wide range of purposes, said Sharon Buccino, a senior director at the National Resources Defense Council, an activist group. This rule would sideline their voices in favor of the fossil fuel industry and more drilling that the public doesn't want and that the climate can't afford. The oil and gas industry has long lobbied for changes to rules governing oil and gas drilling in federal forests and grasslands. The American Petroleum Institute and the Independent Petroleum Producers of America wrote to the federal government in 2018 recommending a series of changes at the Forest Service, including a review of its land management plans. One of their recommendations was the Forest Service, which is charged with managing 154 national forests and 20 national grasslands, better coordinate with the Bureau of Land Management, which, under President Trump, has increased leasing of federal lands for oil and gas drilling. The notice that was published Tuesday says the intent of these proposed changes is to streamline and reduce redundancies to improve agency efficiency and better align Forest Service regulations with those used by the Bureau of Land Management. The Bureau of Land Management is the federal agency primarily responsible for managing federally owned minerals, including those underlying National Forest System lands.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020. Section A. Two ECISD students get new scholarship. Two Ector County ISD graduates are the first recipients of the Sally Ann Powell Memorial Art Scholarship, managed by the Education Foundation of Odessa. Sally Ann Powell was an ECISD art teacher who fought a valiant battle with cancer. In her memory, a scholarship was established and will be awarded to ECISD graduates who wish to become art teachers. The two students receiving the scholarship for the fall 2020 semester are Zoe Herndon, Odessa High School graduate attending Odessa College, and Maria Romero de Mateo, a Permian High School graduate attending the University of Texas College of Natural Sciences. Herndon was the head editor of the yearbook staff, a member of National Honor Society, voted best Latin student her sophomore and junior year, was a VACE, Visual Arts Scholastic Event participant 2016 through 2020, and a UIL math participant 2017-2020. Romero de Mateo was a member of the National Honor Society and an AP art student. It is a privilege to be able to help Sally Ann Powell's family keep her memory alive through these scholarships, Education Foundation Director Celeste Potter said in a news release. Congratulations to these two bright students on their future endeavors. We hope to see them teaching art in ECISD someday. The Sally Ann Powell Memorial Art Scholarship is funded solely through donations. Donations can be made online at www.educationfoundationodessa.org. Simply click on the Donate Online Today link and then select the Sally Ann Powell Memorial Art Scholarship campaign link. Donations may also be mailed to the Education Foundation at Post Office Box 951, Odessa 79760. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Risk of developing brain aneurysm. Dear Dr. Roach, I am a healthy 41-year-old man. My father was a healthy man but died suddenly of a brain aneurysm at age 50. As I get closer to his age, I wonder if I am at risk for developing this condition and whether I can prevent meeting the same fate. MB. Answer. There are many kinds of aneurysms, and some of them do tend to run in families. One of the most common is called a saccular aneurysm. When it ruptures, it is called a subarachnoid hemorrhage, sometimes called a bleed in the brain. For family members of a person who had that kind of hemorrhage, there is a small risk. In your case, with a first-degree relative, parent, sibling, child with an aneurysm, the risk of developing a subarachnoid hemorrhage in the next 10 years is less than 1%. Most of the aneurysms identified from screening are so small that they do not need surgery, so guidelines from the American Stroke Association recommend against screening. However, people with two or more family members with hemorrhages from aneurysm should consider screening, since the risk of developing subarachnoid hemorrhage is over 7% in 10 years.
Another pregnancy is unwelcome surprise to stepdad. Dear Abby, for Friday, September 4th. Dear Abby, my wife of 10 years keeps all kinds of secrets from me. We let her adult daughter, Maud, move in. Maud is 35 and has one daughter. I recently found out that Maud is pregnant again. I heard they had decided to surprise me with the news. The father is the same guy as before. I'm tired of being the third wheel, and I think it's time for me to call it quits. What do you think? Stay or go in Connecticut? Dear Stay or Go, I'm glad you asked. What I think is that you are outnumbered. Maud should be living on her own or with the father of her children. If I am reading between the lines correctly, you have allowed yourself to be stuck with the financial burden that Maud and her irresponsible boyfriend should be carrying. I also think it's time you gave your wife an ultimatum. Either Maud and her daughter move out or you will. Whichever option she chooses, your situation will improve. Dear Abby, I've been married for 5 years. Before meeting my husband, I never thought I would find the one. Recently, I have been having feelings of wanting to experience sleeping with a woman. I've always been sexually adventurous, and I have mentioned a threesome, but he isn't interested. I don't want to die without experiencing sex with a woman, but I also love my husband dearly, and we have a great partnership that I don't want to destroy. Help. Woman seeks woman in New York. Dear woman, it's time for another frank conversation with your husband. Explain clearly that although you love him dearly and do not want to destroy your partnership, you are bi-curious and you would like to experience sex with a woman. However, if his reaction is negative, you must then decide how important fulfilling this fantasy is to you in light of the fact that it could threaten your marriage. Dear Abby, I'm a stay-at-home mother. My husband works Monday to Friday, 10 hours a day. We have been married nearly 4 years. My problem is we never have alone time. I feel if it continues, we will just fall apart. On weekends, we sit home and it's claustrophobic. We have only one vehicle, which he needs to use, so during the week, I'm stuck at home. Being home 24/7 is driving me nuts. We never get out and have family time or a date night. I tell him we need it, but he doesn't seem to care. Could you guide me on what to do? In need of couples time. Dear In Need, stop telling your husband we need a date night and say instead, I need this. If you want our marriage to survive, you will take me out of here so we can spend time without the kids, because I feel like I'm going nuts. A date night every few weeks or once a month isn't too much to ask for. If he is worried about the expense, make sure he knows a hamburger, a sandwich, a drive alone with him is what you need. But if he still doesn't seem to care, then your problem is greater than cabin fever. Horoscopes. Happy birthday for Friday, September 4th, 2020. Exquisitely structured and constructive, you build things to make them work. This year, you do more with your innate talent than you have ever done. It requires a lot of hard work, and you're demanding on yourself. If single, a breakup is accomplished, and you'll be able to move on. If attached, you're together for life, and your partner's still a hottie to you. Scorpio is the sexiest. The stars show what kind of day you'll have. 5, dynamic. 4, positive. 3, average. 2, so-so. 1, difficult. Aries, March 21st through April 19th. 5 stars. You hit your stride early morning and get a lot accomplished. You notice colleagues listening especially closely to what you have to say. You start to think of new ways to make more money. A purchase might be in order. Tonight, answer emails first. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th, 4 stars. You wake up tired, but gather steam as the day grows. Then you are especially energized and excited, and your appearance and personality shine. You are recharged, and relations with the opposite sex goes well. Tonight, make plans to attend an important party. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th, 3 stars. It's a good day to make a donation to a worthy cause. Think carefully before you act. There's a tendency this afternoon to undo all the positive actions you've taken. It's best to work behind the scenes rather than confront a suspected enemy. Tonight, early bedtime. Cancer, 4 stars, June 21st through July 22nd. Yesterday's energy flows into today. Clear your desk for tomorrow's new cycle. Things go more smoothly. You get your message across and everything works better, including computers and other electronic equipment. Tonight, try something new with your sweetie or loved ones. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd, 3 stars. You don't even feel like being at work today, but your ambitions kick in as the afternoon progresses. You strongly want to ask for a promotion. Talk with a higher up who will help. Romance goes on the back burner. Tonight, write down your goals. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd, 4 stars. Tear down the old in order to rebuild. New opportunities come your way that could involve a partner. Everything is enhanced, including your psychic abilities. In a personal relationship, it is the beginning or end of something. Tonight, plan an explorative trip. Libra, September 23rd through October 22nd, 5 stars. You wake up thinking keenly of relationships. Good fortune comes your way today. Confusion and delays related to shared resources start to recede into the past, and you can think of beginning a new cycle you are excited to make. Tonight, refresh yourself with journaling. Scorpio, October 23rd through November 21st, 3 stars. Control your impulses today. Take care of your obligations. Don't get sloppy. Emphasize quality. You're building a creative base for your future. Hard work is required. Be methodical and thorough. It's not a good day for pursuing romance. Tonight, catch up with an elderly relative. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. 3 stars. You feel especially compassionate today. Strive for universal appeal. You're up to the challenge. You tend to think a lot about whatever you're involved in, but keep your resolutions about exercise and watch your diet. Tonight, get out and enjoy the air. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. 4 stars. The first half of the day finds you wanting to be at home with family. The second half, you become more gregarious and begin brainstorming with work colleagues. You have brilliant ideas and receive much praise. Tonight, have a fun night with loved ones. Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th. 3 stars. A sibling or a neighbor is a concern. Today is a good day for writing and speaking. So, address your worry with a succinct email. It will work wonders. You feel restless sitting in your workspace, so take a short trip. Tonight, date night. Pisces, February 19th through March 20th, 4 stars. You wake up thinking about money and accounts. The afternoon finds you in your element and chatting with lots of people. Plan a social gathering where you can shine. Friends demand your attention, and you happily oblige. Tonight, take time out for children.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.